This is Medical Spa MD. Hello and welcome to Medical Spa MD, a show where we give you the lowdown and inside information to help physicians reclaim control of their medical practice and lifestyle. Even if you're clueless about running a business and you're already working a 60-hour week, Medical Spa MD, brought to you by medicalspamd.com, a worldwide community of physicians practicing cosmetic medicine. Hello, Jeff.
Hello, Andy. How are you doing?
I'm very, very well, thank you very much. And I'm interested to see, in the world of medicine, a rather interesting post on your blog entitled Medical Spa Advertising, Keeping It Legal. There's a lot of legislation, isn't there, a sort of governing how you advertise medicines and medical things in the US, as indeed there is in the UK. But how does it differ in the US?
Well, to be honest, I'm not an expert in the UK, and I'm not a lawyer in the US, but there are generally things that you kind of business kinds of things that you can and cannot say. Mm-hmm. But when you're, advertising a medical clinic or a medical practice or kind of healthcare specifically, you just need to be aware that things that you say online are attributable to you, and that they are governed by exactly the same rules and regulations that govern, whether they're in print media or whether you've actually said them to a patient or put them inside of your paperwork. And there was some legislation passed, I think it was probably about 8 months ago now, mm-hmm. that kind of restricted or actually added some kind of caveats to what you must disclose when you're advertising. And so this affects clinics in some kind of odd ways. For example, if you have before and after patient photos of patients and you have provided value to them in some way in order to get those photos, that has to now be disclosed on the website. Now, it's probably is not a huge necessity to kind of run around and decide what it is that you need to actually do for every photo and whether you had an assigned informed consent or what you might have given them if you gave them discounted treatment or some other things. But it is something to kind of be aware of when you're kind of posting materials to your website. Now, we have some information on the site, so you're more than welcome and probably a good idea to kind of do a search on medical spa advertising or legal resources. Legal is one of the things that is covered extensively on the site, since that is always a concern for physicians. Now, the majority of that information is applicable to the United States. So I would add the caveat that if you're outside of the United States, which a huge number of our members are, that you might not either be subject to this regulation or it might differ in some way.
Actually, one of the things on this post towards the bottom of question 8 says, with all these legal requirements, why don't more doctors get prosecuted? Which is a good question.
Well, this is not very high on the list. What this legislation was in effect designed to do was kind of to give regulatory bodies some kind of ability to combat egregious things, claims of, the weight loss stuff and the hidden kind of endorsements. There's a number of things that this was really designed to do, and going around and trying to police before and after photos or claims that are on typical websites is not one of those. And so they're not really kind of, that's not either their mission or their goal or what this was designed to do. It is really to, once they've identified somebody who has become problematic or is making claims that are unreasonable or something else, to kind of be able to have a little bit of a stick to beat them over the head with.
Interesting stuff, the legal framework, isn't it?
It is, and it's complicated, and it has a tremendous amount it has a lot of moving parts that you kind of need to know. One of the things that physicians, one of the questions that we often get has to do, and we'll probably do an entire show about this, we'll get one of the lawyers on, has to do with how you have to compensate or whether you can pay for patient endorsements or patient referrals and some other kinds of things. So we'll probably cover that extensively in another show. But this also kind of gets into that area of if you are paying, and paying can be anything from free treatments to gift certificates to, you know, other kinds of things for referrals. How is that going to, you know, what steps are you going to need to make sure that you are kind of covered? Whether that's a patient who is referring people to your practice, or whether that's another physician, and how you should be handling that. So there is a lot of information on the site. That's a very long topic, and so I don't want to kind of get it in here before our interview with Steve, but we will probably be handling that in another podcast.
Okay, well, that'll be good. So looking forward to that. Okay, well, let's move on to that interview then with Dr. Steve Canope. I've got the surname right there, haven't I, Jeff? You pronounce the K, don't you, Canope?
Yes, you do.
And interesting chap. He is a pioneer. Just a few quick facts before we go into the interview. He is a pioneer in the field of concierge medicine. Now, I won't ask you what that means, Jeff, because I know that you discuss that in the interview, don't you?
We do talk about that, yeah.
And he authored the first book on concierge medicine entitled, not surprisingly, Concierge Medicine.
It's no surprise at all.
And he used to play the French horn, so he's a bit of a musician as well by the sound of it.
Yeah, he was a pro. He was a professional French horn player before he became, you know, went to medical school and became a physician.
Excellent. Okay, well, let's get into the interview then.
Steve, you run a concierge medical clinic. What is your definition of concierge medicine?
Well, concierge medicine is nothing more than fee-for-service medicine, really what Mark Swalby did four decades ago. So the only difference between what I do and what doctors did before the days of third-party payers is that I collect a fee annually up front once a year. But many concierge doctors bill on a monthly basis. So really, concierge medicine is nothing more than a return to private medicine.
So you actually bill your patients like on a year? They're not actually paying monthly, they're paying at a yearly contract?
Correct. Right. So in my practice, people pay me $6,000 a year as an individual, or $10,000 for a couple, and they write a check once a year. And at the end of that year, if they're happy, then they write another check and they sign up again and sign another contract. And that's how I run my practice.
And so, you know, to kind of delve into that, what is your kind of churn rate on that? How often do you have patients kind of turn over? I assume if patients move, there's a number of reasons why this could happen, but how many, sure. You know, what is the percentage of patients that you keep year to year?
In terms of people who don't move, we've got about a 98% re-up rate. So people generally, once they get a taste of this, are pretty happy with it and they come back. To be honest, I probably terminate more people than leave. So probably a couple people a year I'll ask to leave early, or I just won't renew because I can't help them. And generally those people fall into two categories. Number one, they're drug abusers and they thought that they could basically buy my DEA number and that doesn't become apparent for a while. Or if people have major personality disorders, and specifically I would say the groups that are most incompatible with this kind of medicine would be people who have true somatization disorders, or people who are flaming narcissists, who again think that they bought your heart and soul for $6,000 a year. Those people, we just kind of have a come to Jesus talk, and if it doesn't work, then you know, typically what I will do in those situations is refund all their money, shake their hand, part as friends, and that's the end of it. But it's really very much kind of a two-way street. This has to work for both sides, and so I'll bend over backwards to help somebody and to do everything I can for them medically. But if somebody comes here with a secondary agenda that's not a good use of my time, then we just shake hands and part as friends.
And so those are the clients that don't work out. Who is your kind of perfect target client?
Well, it's really a group, because if I had all sick people, I probably would be too busy. And if I had all really healthy people, I would not, you know, keep my skills sharp. So I would say that my practice really splits into three groups. There is a group of acutely ill, very sick people, people with brain tumors, cancer, serious heart failure, diabetes, the kind of thing that every internist deals with. And we've got some, probably a third of the people who are middle of the road in terms of medical complexity, hypertension, low diabetes, high cholesterol, things like that. And then there are people, frankly, who just want me available, hard to get them in for their annual physical. You know, I drag them in, spend a couple hours with them once a year, and they don't really want to see me much more than that. They just want me to be available in case something happens. So it's really very much a mix.
Is there a way that you keep that mix, meaning that are you kind of aware, or do you kind of juggle the fact that you have so many patients that already have existing disorders, you know how much time that's going to take up, so that you kind of do you vet incoming patients in order to kind of maximize your practice?
Well, I don't vet them to maximize, say, income by calling out the healthy ones. Really, people just kind of come to a practice like this by word of mouth. And so if there's a good personality match, regardless of the complexity of their medical problems, then I'll take them. But I do sit down and I offer, you know, a 30-minute complimentary interview. And this is really an opportunity for both of us to make sure that this is a good match.
And what are the questions that you're asking in that interview?
Well, you know, I really ask very open-ended questions, and I kind of let them talk, and I really get a feel for them and see what their expectations are. And, you know, most of the people who come in here have a good idea of what it's about. They're usually referred by friends, and we usually hit it off very well, and things go smoothly. But, you know, occasionally, like I said, you know, you'll get somebody who will come in, and this is really important for folks who are going to offer this kind of a service. If you get a sense that somebody really has some sort of strange agenda, or, you know, I get phone calls that go something like this: I got your name, I'm coming to see you because every other doctor in Tucson sucks, and I have fibromyalgia and chronic fatigue syndrome, and I've been to the Mayo Clinic and they fired me, and, you know, you start hearing stories like that.
Sure.
You know, you say, we need to sit down and have a talk. And if I think somebody, you know, is primarily dealing with psychiatric issues, I certainly don't jump to that conclusion after not having examined them and taken the full history. But if I really get the sense and say, look, you know, I suspect, I can't say for sure, I suspect that every other doctor doesn't suck, and I'm not going to be your savior. You know, I would strongly suggest you see a psychiatrist before you see me, and I've done that as well. So what I'm trying to say is that this is a big investment for the doctor. It's a big investment for the patient. And when you are paying somebody a lot of money to be taken care of, and as a physician, you're going to put a lot of energy into this. You really want to trust your gut and feel like this is going to be a good long-term relationship. Because if you spend, you know, hours and hours with a patient and there's no way to help them, you're both just going to be frustrated and it's going to end badly. And so that's the voice of 10 years of experience.
So have you been practicing concierge? You've been practicing concierge for almost 10 minutes, or 10 years. You were practicing mm-hmm. clinical medicine with third-party reimbursement before that and became disillusioned with that. Is that accurate?
Yeah, that's very much accurate. So about the first 10 years of my practice, I've been in practice almost 20 years now. So the first 10 years I, you know, was seeing typical 40 patients a day, you know, anywhere from 5 to 15 in the hospital. On top of that, you know, every 10 to 15 minutes, another patient in my clinic, and chief of medicine at the same time, director of the ICU, and it was frankly brutal. And, you know, I just constantly had this nagging sense that I was not doing the right thing, that I did not have time to really devote, you know, to taking excellent care of all these folks, because I was just on a treadmill. And I was exhausted, and I hated my life, and I was not reimbursed well, and it was a disaster for me personally and professionally. I just hated it.
And so, what was the move that you made, or the decision that you made? Where did you learn about concierge medicine someplace, or you thought this is the route I'm going to go?
Well, interestingly, I was approached by a patient who told me about this, and the first practice opened about 4 years prior to mine, MD Squared, up in Seattle, and some affluent business folks in my community came to me and said, look, you know, are you really happy, you know, seeing 40 patients a day? You know, you're a bright guy, you're well-trained, we like you, but, you know, we feel like you're on the treadmill with us too. You know, it's, you know, every 12 to 15 minutes, you're on to the next patient. And, you know, wouldn't you rather, you know, get better reimbursement and have more time to do what you were trained to do? And initially, you know, I kind of had the typical response, which is, well, it sounds elitist, I don't think so. But the more they came back and the more they talked, the more I had to confront the fact that I really hated my professional life. I mean, it was never the medicine that I hated. I mean, I love my practice now and I love medicine. It was, I hated seeing so many patients, and getting paid so little, given the amount of time and effort I'd invested in my career.
And so how did you kind of come to terms, or where was the tipping point for you where you said, you know, how do you deal with the kind of elitist remarks around that?
Well, it was very interesting. When I did this, it was so new. There were maybe, I don't know, half a dozen of us across the country who were doing it and at least doing it and talking about it. And so there was a front page newspaper story in the Arizona Daily Star here, and there was a physician quoted from the university, an academic, who said, this is boutique medicine at its mercenary worst. And so I knew I was on the right track because, you know, the academics hated me. And so, you know, I just basically didn't care because I went through this whole process of thinking about it. And you know, I mean, I reread the Hippocratic Oath. I didn't see anything in there about being abused by HMOs and third-party payers and getting 10% of your billing and being sued by patients, you know, if you didn't give them exactly what they wanted. I mean, the whole system, it just became very clear to me, this whole system was broken, and the idea of solving that problem by being a martyr just seemed absolutely retarded to me. I mean, it just didn't make any sense at all. I mean, why would I want my lawyer or my doctor to be overworked, unhappy, and hate every professional day of his life? I mean, why would that be good for me as a patient? And so, you know, interestingly now, 10 years later, looking back on this, when I was sort of blazing the trail here, you know, there are about 6 doctors in this town now who are practicing concierge medicine, many of whom said what I was doing 10 years ago was unethical, and somehow their ethics have all changed. So, you know, this is nonsense. We should not be concerned about, you know, what other people think of us if we feel that we're doing the right thing for ourselves and our patients. And to those people who say it's unethical, I say, what's the gold standard of ethics? And who's to decide? And you know, if you're seeing 30 or 40 patients a day, giving them short shrift, and they're unhappy, and you're unhappy, and you're being beaten up by a third party payer, somehow this is the ethical gold standard. I mean, you know, when I made this transition, there's a long history of the battles that I waged with the HMOs in this town, and from my perspective, the majority of physicians were working with HMOs to limit care. They knowingly did so. They worked with these third-party payers to limit care to their patients for the HMO profit so that they could get a paycheck. And so I find that the third-party model is far less ethical than what I'm doing. I simply offer a service. If people are willing to pay for it, they pay for it. And for those who can't, I've got about 50 patients in my practice that I treat free of charge. Not to placate my critics or to do what they want me to do, but because that makes me feel good, and I do that of my own volition. But the idea that somehow working under Obamacare or working for Medicaid or Medicare or United Healthcare is somehow the ethical gold standard, and charging patients fees for services unethical is just it's a straw man. It's a silly argument.
And so, when you made the decision, what did you actually do? How did you set out your shingle?
Well, it was a little different 10 years ago in that I had the luxury of having a big practice, and what I did was I just started out with a pilot project 1 year with 4 patients. And I thought, well, I'll give this a try and see how it works. And so I really ran what's called a mixed or a hybrid practice without really knowing it back then. That's the term we would use today. And, you know, the next year was 10, and that was 16, and then it was 30, and it just grew. And then ultimately 6 years ago, I dropped the Medicare and slowly, you know, I tried to keep patients on as long as I could and just let them fall off by attrition as opposed to sending out letters to my existing patients and telling them, you know, they'd have to find a new doctor. So I would say, you know, over a period of about 6 to 7 years, we just transitioned and ultimately converted to a full fee-for-service practice.
So is it internists that are most suited for concierge medicine?
Internists or family practitioners. And, you know, I think pediatricians are next, and several of those have already put their toe in the water. And yeah, what you really need is a diagnostician, a point person, kind of a shell answer man. That's what people are paying for, because, you know, though some people maybe with terrible coronary disease might benefit from having a concierge cardiologist, most people go in for a procedure with a specialist and they'll get some degree of limited follow-up, but it's not kind of ongoing care. So the value here is really in access and time. You know,
so do you see concierge medicine as kind of growing out as being a kind of a minor player, growing out to be a mature kind of minor player, but where specialists are still going to be need to be paid for by third parties?
I think at the moment that's the way that it is. I mean, again, if we kind of take this discussion full circle and go back to where we started, you know, really, what is concierge medicine? It's nothing more than fee for service. I think until doctors decide to take back their profession and go to a fee for service model, then that's the way it's going to be. But I don't think it's gotten bad enough for specialists yet that they're willing to take a risk and drop the third party payers.
I'm not aware of any kind of concierge specialist, but are you?
No, I'm not. I mean, I get calls from specialists all the time asking if I think the model can work, and I say it'd be pretty hard. I know that some of the orthopedic groups across the country, you know, the well-established kind of high-profile guys, are working on a fee-for-service only basis. And I think you're going to start seeing that, say, with total knees and hips. You'll see the gurus, you know, starting to say, I'm sorry, we don't take any third-party payers.
And do you think that'll put pressure on the third-party reimbursement? Because what will obviously happen will be physicians will come out of school, and unless they've got connections or something, they will probably go into the kind of current system. But as they build up a practice, they may well decide to transition to a fee-for-service model of one sort.
Sure. Yeah, I think that's true. You know, I get a lot of calls from young doctors, medical students, you know, how do I do this? And I say it's very difficult to do right out of training because, you know, you need a reputation and you actually need to have experience too. So, you know, those first few years where you're seeing, you know, 30 or 40 patients a year is actually important for your personal development or your professional development. So I think you're absolutely right. I think people will probably start out in a third party system, and then as they develop a reputation and a desire to be free, they'll.
Now, in your practice, you're the only physician, as far as I understand. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
Is there anything that would prevent you, meaning being inside of this as a business, is there anything that would prevent you from hiring younger physicians or something and building out your practice as a larger clinic?
Nothing would prevent it, and many people do that, and many people start franchises and all that stuff. But, you know, my whole desire was just to be happy running my own shop and practicing medicine. And I actually, you know, I did hire one young physician that didn't really work out. It wasn't a good match. And I think that, you know, if that's your goal to make a whole bunch of money, then you can start a franchise and do that. But, you know, when I look at the franchises, I think this is the reason I got out of third-party payers. I don't want a manager. I don't want a third-party business person. It's certainly not necessary. They take a big chunk out of your income and they control you, and there's really no benefit. And so that's one thing I would caution people. You know, when I started doing this and started getting some national press attention, I started getting calls from a couple of the larger franchises, and the message was, well, you know, we've got a legal team, we can make it bulletproof. And when I sat down with my attorney and I said, what can I do that you can't do, you know, we concluded that there was virtually nothing. And you know, I think doctors are oftentimes afraid to strike out on their own, but, you know, that's where the fun is, because once you're free, I can't tell you how much fun it is to practice medicine, because that's what I've got the time to do. And that almost sounds ridiculous in this day and age. But I don't hate my job. I like it. I like my patients. And I like the practice of medicine, and I get to do it on my own terms. And I mean, that was my goal.
And so as a physician, what skill set did you have that other physicians don't have to be able to kind of manage this?
It was a narcissistic personality disorder. So as everybody else was bitching and moaning, I mean, honestly, what happened was I backed myself up into a corner. I stood up and said to the HMOs, screw you. You know something? I'm not going to do this. I'm dumping your contract. I'm tired of your approval and pre-approval and all of this crap, and I'm just not going to play well with others. And I think it was, you know, people originally thought that I was crazy. And so if you asked about a skill set, it wasn't a skill set. I didn't have business knowledge at the time. I just had used the word no, and I said, I'm not going to do this. I'm not going to work this hard to have some clerk on the end of the line tell me that my patient doesn't need an MRI scan, and I'm not going to bill $150 for a stress test and get a $19 reimbursement. I'm not going to do that anymore. I'm just not going to play this silly game. And, you know, I don't know. I have to tell you, you know, I went to medical school at Cornell, and everybody made fun of, you know, kind of the old-time surgeons, you know, Perry and Shires and those guys, because, you know, they had a lot of testosterone. But I can't imagine them ever putting up with the kind of crap that doctors put up with today. And I don't think it benefits doctors and patients. It is not compassionate. It is not cool. It does not improve patient care. It just creates cynicism. And I think that, you know, as long as we're talking about, you know, the demise of medicine, I think some of it rests squarely on the shoulders of doctors. We need to stand up and say, this is our profession. Nothing personal, but get out of my backyard. Get out of my sandbox. You add nothing as a third-party payer. And so if you ask what I had that these other people didn't have, it was that attitude. I couldn't imagine living my life for some suit on Wall Street telling me how to practice my craft. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. Which is, you know, while a huge number of our members are moving into cosmetic medicine for exactly those types of reasons. You know, it's to get rid of the third party payer and to have fee for service and to be paid for your, you know, time and effort. And you made an interesting comment, which was that you didn't have any business skills, which intimated that you now do have business skills. What are they, or what have you learned?
Well, I'm a triathlete and a martial artist, and one of my great visions was to have an exercise facility which was part of my medical office. And to make a long story short, about 8 years ago, I got a bank to actually loan me and a partner $1.5 million to build this facility. And to make a long story short, the whole thing kind of blew up over some partner issues. And I rapidly had to go from pie in the sky, what I'd like to see, you know, what utopia would look like, to what happens when you've got your name on a $1.5 million note and you've got a business that's financially in trouble. And I learned real fast about cash flow, what it meant, you know, not signing personally on notes, dealing with lawyers, dealing with partners, and making a huge number of mistakes. And so now what I do, and when patients, when other doctors consult with me, you know, my message is to run lean and mean, to be really, really careful, to be the opposite of the U.S. government in this economy. You know, don't spend any money you don't have. Keep your overhead low. Look at the books. Understand this, because if you bury your head in the sand and you don't know how your business operates, then it's a disaster waiting to happen. So I acquired a skill set by really making lots of mistakes, and then having some smart patients actually who sort of took me the other wing and said, you know, you're a typical doctor. You need to understand this. This is how this works. This is how that works. And so it really was kind of an evolution.
Yeah, if your medical, you know, your office manager is the one who really understands all of this, and you don't, you're probably not in a good position to start these types of business. Right? I mean,
yeah.
which is absolutely. which is in a huge number of medical practices, the physician doesn't know where the, you know, the paper clips are, doesn't know where anything is. It's the office manager who knows all of this information, you know, all of this. And if you don't have access to that, or you're not the one who knows that, if those questions don't actually go to you because you don't want to answer those, you're probably not in a good position to start running actually the business.
I think you hit the nail right on the head. And you, I mean, you ought to know every invoice that comes into, goes out of your office. You ought to be looking at what the local physician supply company is charging you. What do you mean we got a $1,600 bill? What is this? We didn't order, you know, 32 boxes of gloves this month. You know, did this kind of stuff. And all of that adds up. And though it may seem like a colossal waste of your time, it's absolutely necessary, because physicians, you know, traditionally behave the way I did. You know, you're somehow above all of this nuts and bolts bookkeeping stuff, and then pretty soon you find yourself in very deep trouble. So I couldn't agree with you more. You ought to know exactly what your office manager is doing, look at all the numbers, and know what's going on, because if the day you turn your back, that loyal employee just embezzled, you know, $25,000-$50,000 from you. That's the typical physician story.
Yeah, which is not uncommon. Embezzlement is the number one, you know, crime committed in medical office. Yeah, and it's you know, I have had partners who I had one partner who lost, you know, he thinks between $40,000 and $70,000 from an office manager over about 3 years, and it's, you know, it is very, very that's very common, and there are ways to manage that and stuff. But one of the most important is to actually know what's going on inside of your clinic.
Well, I think that's really true, and I'll give you a little story that way too, just to kind of get into the depth of what I think you need to do to manage an office as you're discussing. I had some employees that were problematic, and money was disappearing and things like that, and they came in one morning and they found bank cameras in the ceilings, and you know, I went to the bank so frustrated that day after dealing with, like, you know, my fourth delinquent employee, and I was just standing there at the bank. I looked at those black little domes in the sky, and I thought, you know what? Nobody misbehaves in the bank because they know they're being watched. And that may seem really crude and cynical, but you know what? Ever since I installed those things 6 years ago, I have no problems. And so, you know, there are ways to solve all of these issues so that you don't have to be burdened with it. You just approach, you know, the running of the business, I think, logically, the way that you do, you know, your diagnostics or anything else in medicine.
Now, let me ask you this. You used to be a professional French horn player, according to your bio. Now, that puts you in what I would categorize as a creative camp. But creative guys tend to not like to play by the rules very much. Do you think that has something to do with your wild streak?
Well, I mean, perhaps. I mean, I... Yeah, I mean, I don't like to play by the rules. I think I get along well with patients, and I have great interpersonal relationships with them. But yeah, to me, a physician ought to be a leader, right? You ought to be an individual. And so the whole idea that you're going to be subjugated by, you know, by a suit or somebody else or the government, just, you know, runs contrary to the idea that wait, you're supposed to be the guy who stands at the bedside at 3 o'clock in the morning and makes these life and death decisions. It's incongruous. So, yeah, I mean, I'm encouraging people, if they take one message from this, it's misbehave. I mean, if you think there's any nobility in following, you know, this system like a sheep and sacrificing your life, I think that's a terrible mistake. I think it's a tragedy to spend all this time and effort on your education. Be rude. Say no. Do things your way, and then you'll have the pride and the creativity to do something truly wonderful, and people will benefit from your gifts. But if you just sit there and whine about how bad it is, which is what most of my colleagues do at the doctor's lounge, oh, you know, we're such victims. I want to say, why don't you, like, do something to get out of this situation? Right?
Exactly. And you know, there is a lot of kind of bitching and moaning about you know, the current situation. But the first step is actually to decide that you're going to do something, and second is actually start doing you know, anything in order to change that. Let me ask you this: with the concierge kind of model, whether it's a straight free fee for service or whether it's kind of a hybrid, where are the potential abuses of that system?
Well, I mean, other than sort of you know, a psychopathic personality disorder or something, I can't really see that that concierge medicine is vulnerable to that. In fact, really the opposite is true if you think about it. I mean, my patients can vote with their feet at any time. They can decide not to renew. And if they're on a month-by-month payment basis in other models, they can just decide, you know, that, that they're not going to pay you anymore. So the beauty of this model is that it really kind of puts a magnifying glass on the quality of service somebody's getting. And since they're paying for it, they can withdraw at any point. So I don't really see this, you know, unless you're a Conrad Murray and you're, you know, and you're giving propofol to Michael Jackson and you're calling that concierge medicine. I can't really, see that there's an abuse, you know, and then clearly you've got a guy who's got his own psychiatric issues or he wouldn't be giving propofol to a patient at home. So, I think the beauty of this is it keeps everybody honest. And so, you know, I never take this for granted. I mean, I think it's my job every day to get up and provide people with the best care and to stay on top of my game and to do all that. And, you know, frankly, if I don't, I'm not going to keep getting patients from some HMO. I get patients by referral. And so, you know, it really puts pressure on me to stay on my toes, you know, even if I'm not motivated that way, you know, if you say, what are the weaknesses, even if somebody is not motivated to kind of be their very best, you know, the model forces you in that direction.
So a couple things about the model. Why have you decided to make it a, you know, not a month-to-month fee in your practice, but a year-to-year contract?
You know, it just started out that way. And since I have more of a retainer basis practice as opposed to these monthly contracts where people often also, you know, they have a small retainer fee and they will take third-party reimbursement as well. I just started out in that mode. I do it. And it's a lot simpler. I send somebody a letter once a year and say, are you happy? Do you want to do this? Is this still working? And they say yes, as opposed to, you know, having credit cards and having someone to run all that thing and having them, you know, deduct money every month. I mean, you can do that and that's fine. But,
so really it was kind of a more of a decision on overhead, meaning that you cut your, you know, accounts receivable or your outgoing bills by, you know, they're only 1/12 of what they were.
Right. It's just sort of simple, and I don't have to worry about credit cards or anything like that. I mean, people just write a check. And so I'm aware that you know, for example, there are many, many concierge practices that charge only $1,500 a year for a retainer spread out every 12 months, and those doctors will accept third-party payers as well. And I understand that for a lot of people who can't write a $6,000 check, that's a perfectly good model and works very well for them. So for that, they just have a slightly, you know, bigger business machine, and they run it that way. But, you know, I've just been fortunate. I've been able to keep it simple.
And so how many, you know, staff members do you have in your clinic?
I have a whopping one staff member. And I've got a half-time person who comes in too. But really, that's all I need for a couple hundred patients.
And typically, how many times your patient, in your patient population, how many times a year is a patient seeing you?
You know, it really varies. It literally can be once a week to once a year. And so that's kind of getting back to that three group, I'd say. And on average, I'd probably say I see people 3 to 4 times a year for the moderate group. The high acuity group, I might, you know, put them in the hospital 2 or 3 times a year and see them once a week. And there are people, and I sit down with them. I say, do you really want to write a check to see me once a year? Yep, I just want to know you're there. And so I give those people what they want, too.
And that, which brings up an interesting point. You're getting two benefits here. One is time, and the other is you know, monetary, probably improvement. How much money is a concierge physician? You know, what are the levels across the U.S. If you know that concierge physicians are kind of making? Are they roughly analogous to their income before they moved to concierge medicine, and the time kind of makes their lifestyle a lot better, or are they actually making more money as well?
Most of the people that I know who've been doing this a couple of years are doubling or tripling their salary. So you know. So there you have it. You know, you're kind of starting to approach many specialist salaries, seeing a third of the patients that you would see otherwise, and So all of a sudden you're getting compensated and you're not running like a chicken with your head cut off, and you actually have time to read and do a good job.
And have you seen concierge practices actually go out of business? Are you aware of any physicians that have tried this, not liked it, or have actually performed so poorly that they've actually gone out of business and gone back to clinical, traditional clinical practices?
I don't know any of those people. I'm sure they exist, but generally what happens is that people have a pretty good sense, or they'll use a management company or a franchise that does an analysis first. And usually, the typical person that would convert would be, sort of a mature internist or family practitioner who's got a big patient base. They've been doing this for 10 years. They've got a good reputation in the community, and they've got a following, so that, if they can send out a letter and get a couple hundred people guaranteed, they're going to fly okay. So most people don't make the jump unless they're pretty sure and they've got what it takes.
Okay. Let me ask you this. So you're speaking at the Medical Fusion Conference in November. What is it that you're going to be talking about, Steve?
Well, we're really going to talk about this issue of what people need to do to take back their professional life. And I don't mean it in kind of a touchy-feely way, but a real way. I mean, I think that some people listening to this may say, I think this is possible. Other people may listen and say, gee, this guy sounds completely different from me. I don't think I could do that. It sounds too risky. And really what I'm going to focus on, since this isn't going to be just a group of internists, is what what are the personality traits and what are the skills you would need to stand up on your own and practice medicine on your own terms? So that's going to be the crux of my talk.
Got you. Now, you've also launched, let me bounce over here. What is the name? What is the name of the international kind of concierge rescue medicine? Concierge Medicine International. Tell me about that. How do you get involved with Greg and launch that business?
Well, Greg Bledsoe is a world class ER doctor and a wilderness medicine expert, and we came up with the idea of people who are traveling abroad, or guys who go on safaris or get into trouble in the Philippines. What if those people had not only an internist that they could contact 24/7, but really what would amount to their own private emergency room physician as well? So that if somebody falls out of a hunting blind in Africa, what would it take to get somebody on the ground there, rescue that guy, get him to a hospital of his choice for his specific problem in the United States, and get him taken care of. And that's the concept. So we've just started this. We've just opened up our website, and we're starting to meet with folks who have an interest in this, for example, in the hunting and the safari community. And so it's an exciting project, and it's a very interesting way, I think, to combine personalized emergency medicine with internal medicine. And one of the triggers for this is that one of my patients got stuck in a country with socialized medicine, and he had a rescue service which failed to perform, and the guy was stuck there, and I had a $3,000 phone bill for a week and could not get him out of the country, and it was a nightmare. And so this sort of spawned the idea of what if we could get EMTs, paramedics on the ground, or get Greg on the ground within 24 hours, get somebody at the bedside, get them, helicoptered out on a med jet to, wherever they need to be, again, depending on the nature of the problem.
So this service sounds as though it's significantly more than a traditional concierge, an international concierge plan.
Call and discuss price, yeah, but I mean, this is sort of an interesting venture for people who really are world travelers, and it was a chance for Greg and I to collaborate and really do something creative.
And since your practice has now allowed you the time in order to actually investigate other businesses.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's you know, it's kind of amazing when you have time to think. I mean, I learned about a new catheter, you know, over the weekend by a guy named Rich Heuser up in Phoenix, who's a world-class interventional cardiologist. And, you know, I was thinking about it, he's working on this one patient. I said, God, this might be perfect for another patient. And I sent him an email, and he goes, God, thank you for thinking about me. And I thought, well, this is sort of the nature of concierge medicine. You're always thinking, and even your patient's not there when you've got these complex problems. You know, you've got the time to search the world or the country and find, you know, the very best person who may have an innovative solution for some patient. And it's a very exciting, rewarding way to practice medicine.
Do you see yourself maintaining this practice into the future?
Yeah, I do. I don't. You know, I think I'll do this as long as I still enjoy medicine. I've been approached by people asking me to franchise or to join big university groups and sort of be their CEO and all that. And I realize that, you know, I don't want to do that because, you know, I have a great life right now. And, I make enough money. Maybe I could make more doing something else, but, you know, I have great freedom and I love what I do. And so I think I'm going to keep doing this for a while.
Have you seen any physicians that have actually transitioned out of concierge medicine then once they've got it, meaning that they have decided that they're going to retire? And is the plan that you would actually sell your practice then to someone else who's kind of steps in kind of a traditional handoff?
Well, I know some people who are talking about that because, you know, they think that this is a legitimate income stream, if you will. Some business people have talked about that and valuing the practice. And I suppose, you know, if you brought in a young associate and your patients got to know them and they sort of understood that was your long-term plan, and then, you know, you may in fact have a saleable practice the way that Marcus Welby did.
Very challenging, though. I assume that a huge amount of this is personality driven.
Well, I think it is, and so there's no question that it's a match, and it's I don't know. I'm sort of an excellence junkie. When I look around and I look at the kind of things that interest me and the kind of businesses where, you know, there's one guy who makes the best product and is just passionate about it. You know, I think you're right. I think a lot of times that dies with the person, but you know, that's sort of the fun thing. And I really enjoy kind of mom and pop businesses and people who like to do their very best and do it their way.
Well, that's it for the show. Thank you very, very much for listening and hope you enjoyed it. Now, we'd like to hear from you, of course. So if you've got any questions or comments, please send them along to our email, which is podcast@medicalsparmd.com, or leave a comment in the physicians forum on the website, which is medicalsparmd.com. Now, if you're a subscriber, that's great. If you haven't subscribed yet and you'd like new episodes automatically downloaded, then you can find us in iTunes. Just search for Medical Spa MD or go along to the medicalsparmd.com website and click on podcast, and there's ways to subscribe there as well. Now, as always, please consider everything we say to be complete conjecture and random speculation, not medical or legal advice. Laws and regulations vary everywhere, so consult a medical or legal professional in your country before taking any action. Well, it's goodbye from Andy White
and Jeff Barson,
wishing you all the best until we see you next time on Medical Spa MD.